because we have a lot to catch up on, and that's fine. A lot to catch up on sounds ominous, but I think that will give us a wider time at the end for us to have a group discussion and highlight some of the pieces. So hopefully this will all work and all be clear. A couple small notes. What I've been doing is I read through the book a month ago, and then each week I'm going back through it. I'm listening to the John Cleese recordings. If you're following along with those online, you will have realized that some of them are simply not there. And I discovered that yesterday and said, letter 16 was missing. And I looked ahead, and there's five more that are missing. So I've been able to find a separate, you can't find it anywhere. It doesn't exist. There's only like cassette tapes of this. Some of you remember cassette tapes? Okay, good. There's only cassette tapes, and I was able to locate another digital copy, and I will find a way to post it so that you can access it this next week. So if you're listening along and want to continue, I'll make sure the missing files are available. Because I listened to the other versions that are available, and they're horrible. The John Cleese version is by hugely superior to the other ones. John? Yeah, okay. I mean, the other ones are like over-dramatized and, you know, some of them have been edited, and they've updated the language, and I thought, oh, what are you doing? Just let us deal with it. Okay. As I said, I'm going to talk first tonight about Romantic theology, so if you've got your notes, you can follow along with those things, and then we'll shift into our discussion time after that. So I want to talk about Romanticism for a few minutes. Someone asked me last week about, Brian, or asked me about objectivism, and I was looking this up this week, and formally, the philosophy called objectivism is associated, yes, with Ayn Rand. Lewis is a lowercase o objectivist, and so there's a kind of, and this is one of the reasons she absolutely hated him, is because it was so close, but these things. So my language of objectivism needs to be edited to say, you know, objectivist, but anyway, for those of you who really care about that tiny debate, there you go. So Romanticism is another ism, and this one's important, and you've got some notes here. It was a very popular 18th to 20th century philosophical and kind of theological movement. So one of the things that happened was that Isaac Newton, whose name you know because he invented calculus and he studied the motions of things, he also wrote books on optics. And he diagnosed how the eye worked and how things happened. And he was doing some really clever scientific work on the sciences and seeing new things and revealing them. And everybody read Newton's books and thought they were amazing. But some people hated them because people who loved beauty read Newton and felt like he's just reduced things that are utterly beautiful to mathematics. And they're not beautiful anymore. How can I do this stuff? And so there was a counter movement against Newton, and it was led by people like Goethe. If you know Goethe, he was this very, very popular German author in the 18th century, writing his movement is called Sturm und Drang and all this kind of like evocative, violent stuff. He's the guy who wrote Faust, the famous figure of the devil, Mephistopheles, which really is kind of a Screwtape influence. All this is information that can go into your head and leave later. Just remember, Goethe, hugely influential, hugely popular. Everybody's reading him. Everybody's studying him. And there are deep emotional lines in the German soul leading from, you know, there's almost a direct line from Goethe to kind of what happens in Hitler, although they're not the same. They're not the same. Because Goethe also influences a poet called Novalis, who's writing these deeply romantic things. Novalis influences people like William Wordsworth and Coleridge, who wrote some of the greatest poetry ever written in the English language. Through them, by proxy, we reach George MacDonald. George MacDonald wrote fairy stories, and he's basically the grandfather of all modern fantasy. So if you're reading Lewis or Tolkien or any other book today in modern fantasy, the granddaddy of it is George MacDonald. He's the guy who kind of set the stage for what does a fairy story look like? And these deeply, deeply emotionally compelling, not manipulative, but wonderful, wonderful stories written by him. And then through this line, so, you know, Goethe, Novalis, Wordsworth, Coleridge, George MacDonald, we get to people like Lewis, Tolkien, and Charles Williams. They are the direct descendants in this line from these things. So it's a very powerful, very evocative movement in how we think about it. Now, what is Romanticism? Again, I get these words to you on your notes, so you didn't have to write them down. A query into the metaphysics of beauty, This may be too many big words in a row. A query, an inquiry, a study of what's the... We experience beauty. We see things. We fall in love with them. We have the sense of beautiful things calling us out of ourselves. What's the nature of that experience? Okay? You guys have walked along the seawall, yes? You've walked at sunset, and you've watched the colors change, and the light hit the lapping waves, and you've heard gulls fly by, and there's been something in you that said, wow, what's the philosophical and what's the nature of that experience? It's the metaphysics of beauty. And we're exploring that. And these guys, these poets, began to write about it and say, this is where meaning is. Meaning is in nature. Meaning is in these experiences. Meaning is in the process of falling in love. How do we think about these things? That, in a sense, in essence, is what Romanticism looks at. So not only do they say we get meaning from these things, but they began to situate the heart of meaning, the heart of what is divine, in these experiences of transcendental beauty. So you're going out on a walk to experience God. That's a Romanticism idea. It's a romantic idea, but it's an idea coming from this philosophical movement, okay? Which, I should say, in part is rejecting the idea that you sit there, you look at the sunset, and instead of saying, wow, you say, well, this is the reflection of the sun's rays passing through our atmosphere at this pressure and temperature, at this latitude along these things, and that's all it is. And you're standing next to someone who says this, and you go, you're an idiot. It's beautiful, right? Like you want to... However true those things are, it's reductive, okay? And that's the kind of reaction. So the other word is, what's the meaning of the numinous? So we have this experience of the holy and of the evocative and something awesome. How many here have been to the Grand Canyon? A handful of you. The Grand Canyon is very big. But there's no clues whatsoever that it's coming. When you're driving in Arizona and you're moving on the highways, you're driving along, it's just kind of flat land, and there's pine trees and stuff floating around. And then you get to the canyon, and you have the reaction that probably the first Western settlers had when they came across it, which was, uh-oh, how do I get over this? It's yawning and expansive and huge, and the sense of the massive makes you just have the sense of fear almost. Fear and awe mixed together at something wonderful. That's the experience of the numinous that we have. It's another one of these transcendental experiences which we get to inquire into in metaphysics. So I've put this poem here for you on your notes. It's a Wordsworth poem, The Tables Turned. I'll read it. You can follow along. It's a wonderful example of this, and you'll see the pieces. So Wordsworth writes, "Up, up, my friend, and quit your books, or surely you'll grow double. Up, up, my friend, and clear your looks. Why all this toil and trouble? The sun above the mountain's head, a freshening luster mellow, through all the long green fields has spread his first sweet evening yellow. Books, 'tis a dull and endless strife. Come hear the woodland linnet. How sweet his music on my life, there's more of wisdom in it. And hark how blithe the throstle sings. He too is no mean preacher. Come forth into the light of things, let nature be your teacher. She has a world of ready wealth our minds and hearts to bless, spontaneous wisdom breathed by health, truth breathed by cheerfulness. One impulse from a vernal wood may teach you more of man, of moral evil and of good than all the sages can. Sweet is the lore which nature brings. Our meddling intellect misshapes the beauteous forms of things we murder to dissect. Enough of science and of art. Close up those barren leaves. Come forth and bring with you a heart that watches and receives." Now, it's a lovely poem. It's elegant. It's got great meter, a great sense of Wordsworth's style, of his sense of the romance of nature, the power of nature to pull us into these things. It's magnificent. You see the tension between the book study and the nature study. You see the tension between things you can learn by dry understanding and things you learn by experiencing them firsthand. Open yourself to the experience, and then you'll learn these things as well. The irony, of course, is that he had to write it in a book for you to get the idea. So it's not quite so easy to escape these things, okay? But I want to highlight also, you can see the seeds of Romanticism here. It's a wonderful example of that, but it's also something that I think that we, in our cultural moment, find kind of appealing. A lot of people talk about the church of nature. I worship outside, right? I worship by hiking and experiencing beauty and being in these places. And I'm not condemning it, but I just want to acknowledge that that is an impulse of romanticism that's coming directly out of that, that line of thinking. So it's interesting. Okay, Lewis is trained, he's reared in this environment, he grows up. And I gave his biography on week one, and I talked about reason and joy last week. And I want to highlight the fact that he was of, for most of his growing up years, he was of two minds. He had this deeply rational, logical self that was trained and built up. And on the other side, he had this deeply emotional self that was appealing to beauty. And he couldn't reconcile the two because he loved myths and stories, which were obviously fake, and he loved reason and rationality, which is hard and real. And how do I be a whole person with these two divisions? And Lewis's integration of his personality, integration of his thinking came with the Christian faith when he realized that, oh, the myth is true, and that in beauty I'm experiencing something of God calling me outward, and that I can use my reason to examine these things. Like, everything fit together for him. All the pieces came together, and that's part of his conversion story, is realizing these things. And that means one of the reasons he becomes part of this movement that we can then call romantic theology. And so I want to take a few minutes now to unpack some of the aspects of romantic theology for you and what this means, because it's very important. I think it's, for the most part, I think it's right. It never becomes an area of like doctrine. Like, we wouldn't put it in our doctrinal statement and say, "Do you agree with the tenets of romantic theology?" That's not the kind. It's a way of putting the puzzle together, but it's not itself the main pieces. So I talked last week about how Lewis sought the source of joy through all these experiences. This thing he called the dialectic of desire. So he hooked himself onto one experience, he discovers that it won't satisfy, he reattaches to another experience, and so forth and so on. And this exchange back and forth, the dialectic, meant that he got closer and closer to the truth. And Lewis saw all these false pursuits as leading him towards real joy. And the phrase I quoted last week, it's on here again, "In coming to understand anything, we are rejecting the facts as they are for us in favor of the facts as they are." And the admonishment in this phrase is that we should reject any settling for something that is less than the real object of our desire. Don't settle for the halfway. Don't settle for the partial. If you have a desire, go for the whole and pursue it relentlessly. We long for a place, but no place satisfies, so don't pretend that one place does. Long for a person, but no relationship fully satisfies, don't pretend that that relationship is the fulfillment. You must reject the facts as you want them to be in favor of the facts as they really are, and only then would you begin to grow in knowledge and truth and selfhood, because your spiritual life is grounded on reality. I'm anchored on reality. So Lewis's understanding of joy matured with his faith, and this is what we call this romantic theology. Foundations for his thinking had already been laid in his study of medieval and Renaissance. His friendship with Charles Williams was instrumental as well. Williams was deeply into this, and full disclosure, Williams is one of the people I wrote my PhD thesis on, so I've spent a lot of time on this subject. Charles Williams was a Dante enthusiast, a fascinating person, and he wrote a very influential book called The Figure of Beatrice. And I want to talk about that book for a moment. He outlines how in Dante, especially Dante's relationship with this woman, Beatrice, medieval thinkers after him found a poignant vocabulary to describe the soul's growth into life with God. I don't know how much you know about Dante. You guys know, if you've heard of the Inferno, there's three parts: Inferno, Purgatorio, Paradiso. But in real life, Dante, I think he's a nine-year-old boy, and he's walking through the streets of Florence, and he sees a girl named Beatrice, and he falls immediately and hopelessly in love with her, and just head over heels in love with her. And, you know, this is a time of arranged marriages, and so he has to marry someone else, and she marries someone else, but for the rest of his life, he holds a candle of love for Beatrice. And this is something that drives him and motivates him. He's very self-aware in his love. He comes to realize that it's not actually Beatrice that he loves, but it's something through Beatrice that he loves. And so his love is directed through this person. And this becomes manifested specifically when Dante writes the Divine Comedy. And of course, his journey through hell is led by Virgil, greatest of the pagan poets. So he's born and dies before Christ, so he can't be in heaven, but he's at the coolest regions of hell, right, above all the bad stuff. That's where we put Dante and Socrates and a few other cool people. He travels upward through purgatory. Virgil gets a special dispensation. But when Dante gets to heaven, the Paradiso, his guide is Beatrice. Beatrice takes on the guiding. And what she does, very fascinating, when they get to the center of heaven, the divine revelation, the revelation of God triune, Beatrice turns and becomes the kind of lens who carries him forward and says, and this is where you were going all along. So something in your love for me was actually a love for the triune God. And my proper place in this was to be a lens through which you could come to a better understanding of who God is. Okay, so that's Dante's kind of big picture, and that's the basis of romantic theology, and I want to break it down a little further into some pieces for you. So first, on your notes, you've got the vision of love. So Dante, there's a vision. He sees Beatrice. Lewis is a kid. He saw his brother's toy garden. His brother had built a little toy garden on a biscuit tin, and it awoke in him something like, what is this land? What is this place? And he had this sense, that first experience of that deep desire, what we call the Sehnsucht feeling. When I was a kid visiting my grandparents, I used to sit in my grandfather's pickup truck, and there was like this hill that went down and back up, and there were trees over the road ahead, and there was something beyond. And whenever we came to that road, I had the sense of, what's over there? It was this sense, my earliest memory of that longing. The summons, when we receive it, the summons of beauty is something that comes to us from God, and it calls us to God. That's our understanding of this doctrine of desire. Now, the reason the summons has power is because the soul is made for union with God. We are made, destined to be made one with God in some meaningful way. We're destined for relationship with Him. And every longing that we experience in human life is a trigger for that deeper longing. And the experience of love points us to that ultimate purpose, at least rightly understood. So human love, although deeply imperfect, nevertheless provides an important framework for understanding how God's divine love toward us works. And so when we fall in love, most everyone here has fallen in love once in your life, I hope, we adjust our personalities, don't we? We become very magnanimous. You're very generous when you fall in love. You're very forgiving. You really let people get away with a lot. Things that you would really complain to your neighbor about in normal life are not a big deal, because love has transformed you in some of these ways. We are gracious, we're kind, we buy gifts, we refuse to think ill of the other person, and we shower them with compliments. And so while experiencing the state of being we call being in love, it's a kind of intoxication. Right? You're quickened, you've lost your appetite, you've had a sense of like your heart beats faster, you look forward to seeing the person in these ways. And in this experience, the biology of love hijacks our whole being, and for a time we become aware of why we're here at all. It's no surprise many people think being in love is the meaning of life. It's the most important aspect of life, that's where I'm supposed to be all the time. And this is something I teach when I perform premarital counseling. I think that falling in love gives you a vision of the kind of person you want to be. All those virtues, your magnanimity, your forgiveness, your selflessness, they are so easy when you're in love. It's easy to be a great person when you're in love. By extension, the vision of joy, the vision of humanity, of beauty, truth, and meaning, the visions perform the same functions. And when we see God's beauty, it calls us towards something of the fulfillment of our person, who we're supposed to be. The other thing I say in my premarital counseling is that when you fall in love, you are all these things, and it's like you spend on your credit card the kind of person you want to be, and then actually becoming a loving person is like paying the bill. Like, now you actually have to do it. You have to transform. It was easy when you fell in love. Now you have to do the work. And I think a lot of people fall short because they realize, oh, it's work to be this person. It'd be much easier just to fall in love again. And they never grow because they just chase experiences. Okay, we're going to come back to that. So there's a process. The very vision necessitates a process. You come into encounter with love. It's easy to be forgiving, and now we have to become the person that we are meant to be. The vision shows you the kind of person you want to be, you want to become, and the journey is the difficult work of actually becoming. It's a process, in Christian language, of dying to yourself, of dying to your pride, your own desire, your self-interest, your envy, your rights, your greed, and even your sense of having accomplished anything, the things you deserve. You die to yourself. when you grow to become the person you're called to be. If love is like IKEA furniture, falling in love is like walking through the shop and saying, oh, I like this, and oh, this is great, and oh, this is fun. And then becoming a really loving person is the business of working with tiny screws and obscure obstructions to actually build the furniture in your life. It's hard work, actually changing. But is the vision worth it? And I think that's the question we get to ask. So we have some stages of the soul. Called to a vision of greatness, great love, great generosity, great forgiveness, great humility. We grow in stages toward that greatness as we doggedly pursue a real vision of love. And the process, we have to refuse to settle for secondary things. Like Lewis, we pursue this dialectic, right? This is it, this is not it. This is it, this is not it. And Lewis writes the following about the dialectic in the sermon, The Weight of Glory, and you've got this in your notes. The books or the music in which we thought the beauty was located will betray us if we trusted them. It was not in them, it only came through them. And what came through them was longing. These things, the beauty, the memory of our own past, are good images of what we really desire. But if they are mistaken for the thing itself, they turn into dumb idols, breaking the hearts of their worshipers. For they are not the thing itself. They are only the scent of a flower we have not found, the echo of a tune we have not heard, news from a country we have never yet visited. Beauty calls you to something else. Wordsworth says, close your books, let nature be your teacher. If you commit to that, nature will let you down. She can't satisfy. There's something beyond nature. And you know what? If you are connected to what's the beyond nature, then you can enjoy nature all you want. You can enjoy those moments when they come. And this is part of having the right priority. So our practical experiences of this vision of beauty are always calling us toward this greater vision. It's not the mountains I want. It's not relationships that I want. It's not Beatrice that I want. It's not biscuit tin lids I want. It's something else. Charles Williams has a phrase for this process. He says, this is thou, neither is this thou. In this moment, I've experienced something awesome. It reminds me of God. This is you, isn't it? And in the same moment, I say, but it's also not you. And we're always checking. This is not you. It's you, but it's not you. There's more. There's something behind. I've got to keep pursuing and keep chasing. So in this relationship, I've experienced something of God, but this relationship is not God. In this worship service, I experience God, but the worship service is not God. God is always bigger. There's always more of him than our experiences plumbed. We will never get to the bottom of God, right? He's infinite in this way. So maybe we can divide this into four stages, okay? In the first stage, the soul is ignorant of the vision of love. You did no idea. The experiences are all around, of course, because God doesn't cease speaking, even if we're not listening, but we've not yet learned to attend to him. You're ignorant. There's a lot of people, there's a lot of young people who haven't fallen in love yet, and when it happens, they'll never forget it, right? It's that moment. There are people in the world who are tone deaf. They can't tell a good song from a bad song. They just know when it has a beat. And they've never heard the beauty of Bach's cantatas. And they never will, right? They've never sat and listened to Chopin play the piano. Well, I've not heard Chopin personally play, but you've never heard Chopin played on the piano, right? And they've never heard these things. They've never heard birds at midnight or the nightingale, or they don't know. And they can't understand it. And yet, some of us, you get it immediately. You're like, those things are magnificent. I've heard them. They transform me, right? There are people who are blind to beauty and people who are blind to the joy of relationships, and that's okay. There's outliers where most people experience these things. But there's an ignorance, and we could pray for their awakening. So the second stage then is we become captivated by a vision. So the experience, we're engrossed. Oh, I never knew. I'll tell you, here's my captivation story. No, it's not a great captivation story. I was a kid, I think I was in fifth, sixth grade, and I went to my librarian, and I said, could you recommend a book for me? I'm kind of bored. And she gave me The Hobbit, okay? And I went home, and I read The Hobbit, and I loved it. This is awesome. I just had so much fun reading it. And I came back to the librarian, and she said, how'd you like it? I said, I loved it. I only wish there was more. I like to imagine that that was a great day in her life, to say, oh, but there is. I was captivated by a different kind of world, by a different vision. I thought, wow, and I pursued more of it, and I've been marked forever because that desire called me into something else. I was transformed by that. Okay. In the third stage, so we're captivated by the vision. We get a vision of what's great, of how things might be. Our eyes are opened. We get an idea of what really living and being alive might look like. And then the third stage, we begin the process of costly self-sacrifice in order to become like the image of the beloved. So in response to the vision, we promise to become worthy of the love. You've seen this. Young, infatuated couples frequently make promises to one another. Oh, I'll be with you forever, right? I wish we could stay like this all the time, right? Don't you? And they try to solicit promises because they don't actually want to be with the person forever. They want to feel the way I'm feeling now forever, right? There's a difference. And so you're marrying a kind of idea, but growth towards perfection is painful. There are painful places in our personalities. Nobody's perfect. I like the phrase, if you find a perfect church, don't join it. You'll mess it up. Okay. None of us has it all together. Things are a bit wonky. There's Proverbs says that as iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. That sounds great, but if two pieces of iron are sharpening one another, they're grating painfully against one another, right? And relationships are this painful process of your partner has discovered all of the rough spots in your life, right? Those things you thought you could keep quiet to yourself and leave behind, and now you're going to experience. And I think I'm talking in, obviously, with romantic theology, marriage is a high example, but I do think there's a call upon the church to provide this function as well. Our commitment to community and friendship as a church also means it can be hard telling the truth to one another and living in community. Okay, all right. The fourth and final stage, we are unified with the beloved, and unity is the goal of a kind of mystical theology, and the soul becomes a kind of moon of love. So I'll draw a picture. I don't know how good this picture will be for you right now, but I think I think this is probably pretty good. So let's imagine. You are here's our son for the moment, right? And little old you comes up, right? And you look, and you're suddenly captivated. You're like, whoa! I had no idea. So there's a sense of beauty and apprehension, and this invites you on a process where you are. The goal of your journey is to move upward, okay? To advance, and at each point, let's give you a couple points here. At each point of this journey, something has to die, like your pride, your sense of getting your own way, like your temper, like your desire for the world to conform to your expectations of it. I could go on, there's lots of things, but something has to die. Until at this point, and I'll for the sake of image, at this point, it's kind of a banana-y moon. We'll give it a banana moon tonight, okay? Right? In spiritual maturity, you are not the sun, but you are the kind of person who can accurately reflect the sun to the world. You have a reflected light. It's not your own light. It's not that you become God. It's that you become polished sufficiently so that you can reflect God to other people. What did I say? Here's our stages. So stage one, you have this apprehension, right? I wrote these down. This is really good when you've memorized it. You're ignorant, you get captivated, and then this process of dying, and then there's this business of self-surrender, okay? And then in the apex of this, you're unified. This part of the goal of what we do. Now, this is a model for, this is broadly speaking, this is one way to picture the model of spiritual formation in the Christian life, okay? One way to picture it. You had some vision of God. You've been invited into a journey of life with God. That journey requires alteration of you. And as he leads you in life, he will bring you confrontingly face to face with things that need adjustment. But the purpose is not to punish you and hurt you. The purpose is to purify and glorify so that you become someone who reflects his light to the world. But this is also a picture of our relationships, that ideally you fall in love, right? This is why romantic theology gets us. You fall in love. She's amazing. I had no idea. Oh, right? And now you have to become the kind of person not only worthy of that love, but who is transformed into the kind of person you want to be in that love. So we're dealing with a whole bunch of big ideas all at once. I'm almost done with this part of the talk, so hang with me for right now. Okay? The good news is I don't have to say that paragraph. That's great. So here's the critique, and I hinted at this, that one of the errors, I think, of human nature is that we think that this experience constitutes solely what it means to love. Love means falling in love. Love means feeling the experience of captivation, when actually love means committing to the vision even when it feels rotten. Love is a commitment to becoming more Christ-like even when life looks grim. Do you see this in Screwtape already? The troughs? Never is our position more dangerous than when a human, thinking everything around him has gone dim, sits and obeys anyway. He's committed to that. The vision was worth it. I'm going to go forward even though I can't see anything at the moment. We're going to come to this, but you'll see how this is flavoring a lot of what Screwtape is, or what Lewis through Screwtape is talking about in the spiritual life. Okay. Every time you are, look, it doesn't matter how many years, if you profess Christianity, it doesn't matter how many years you've been on the Christian journey, you can give up at any point, right? You can kind of walk away at any point from this thing. There's nothing that keeps you in it. I was really startled with one of my university professors because I was young and romantic in the right way, and I thought, wow, you've been married for 25 years. Isn't it easier now? And he said, no. I was alarmed. He said, I could walk away today just as much as I could any day. Now, I think he wasn't planning to walk away, and he hasn't, just to be clear. But he was teaching me something about that my romantic ideas of 25 years of marriage holding you together were wrong. You have to keep working at it. And I thought, oh, that's alarming. And now I've been married almost 20 years, and it's true. Sometimes people have asked me, Jeremy, do you ever imagine not believing in Jesus anymore? And I said, no, I know too much. I can't imagine not believing, but I can imagine being an idiot, right? I can imagine gross disobedience on my part. And I can imagine choosing to live in cognitive dissonance and walking away from my faith because I want to be stupid. But I will know that I'm lying to myself because I can't stop that. Okay, anyway, that's a couple of side notes. And maybe the final note, and you've got these things in your notes, the whole process is really one of enlargement. So St. Augustine says in one of his prayers, O Lord, the house of my soul is narrow. Enlarge it that you may enter in. What a strange prayer. Can you think about that? The house of my soul is narrow. Enlarge it that thou might enter in. Whatever you need to do, God, make me bigger on the inside so there can be more space for you. Could you imagine how painful that might be? To have God tearing down the walls that you have, and maybe, I mean, some of us have cesspits, and some of us are spiritual hoarders, right? We've been stacking stuff in corners for 50 years, and we're saying, okay, Lord, deal with it, and now it's going to stink. But that's a powerful prayer. The house of my soul is narrow, enlarge it that thou might enter in. Lewis says in Surprised by Joy, I insisted that he, God, ought to appear in the temple I had built him, not knowing that he cares only for temples building and not at all for temples built. So I've built a house for God, and I think, great God, this is exactly where you belong. Please fit into the box I've placed for you. And he says, no, I'm making my own temple. I'm making my own space. So we have to tend to where God is rather than where we want him to be. So God is leading us each on a journey, and the goal of that journey is to give you more and more of himself. And that means it's never our idea of God that matters, but the degree to which we permit God to continually mold and shape our idea of him. He's bigger than us. Now, this brings me to the great sin in Lewis's thinking, I believe. Given this process of maturing towards love, the sin we commit along the way is to settle for less than God. We've been given a vision of something amazing and grand and magnificent, but we can kind of settle for something else. Maybe there's three ways we could probably do this. So we can worship God as something that is not God. We could take the gifts of God and we can make them an idol. So we get to Sinai, we worship a cow, a golden calf. We exchange the glory of a giving God for something that eats grass. In A Grief Observed, Lewis is tempted to take the image in memory of his wife who'd passed away and use the image to replace her. And he's very aware of idolatry, and we can hear his frustration. He writes the following: "My idea of God is not a divine idea. It has to be shattered time after time. He shatters it himself. He is the great iconoclast. Could we not almost say that this shattering is one of the marks of his presence?" We get ideas of God, and he's an image shatterer. He breaks our ideas of him because he wants to bring us to himself. And then he writes a short while later, "Not my idea of God, but God. Not my idea of Helen, but Helen. Yes, and also not my idea of my neighbor, but my neighbor." What's a heart's cry? I don't want my idea of God. I want God. I don't want the memory of my wife. I want my wife. I want the real. And I think we can enter into that. I want the real thing. Don't give me any fakes. A second way that we can sin by settling, and this is tricky, is we can accept a good that is outside of God's time. A good outside of God's time. So God may have a good plan for you and for good gifts to give you, but if you're not ready yet, or if he's not given you permission yet, then accepting them now may be a grave sin. So if you're familiar with the story of the temptation of Christ, Satan, there's three temptations, right? Turn these stones into bread. You could feed multitudes. You could raise an army really easily. He says, perform a miracle. People will believe in you, right? That's what you want. You want people to believe in you. So manipulate them by that. Or guess what? You could skip the cross, and I'll give you all the kingdoms of the earth, right? So that's offering all three things to Jesus. And Jesus, of course, says no to Satan on all three counts. What we have to pay attention to is that Jesus does all three things in his ministry. He feeds the multitudes, right? Feeds the thousands. He performs all sorts of signs and wonders, right? And people believe in him. And then he does. Satan says, I give you the kingdoms of the earth. And at the end of Matthew's gospel, all authority on heaven and earth has been given to me. He inherits all authority, but he does it God's way and not the human way. Satan doesn't tempt Jesus with bad things. Satan tempts Jesus with good things. They're just good things that are at the wrong time, things without permission. And I think what we see in that story, and in Screwtape as well, is that Screwtape's greatest power is not tempting you to do bad things, it's tempting you to do good things, but in your own way. Good things outside of God's timing and outside of God's place. Okay, I'm not pointing at you, that's right. Just hold my pencil a little closer these moments, okay? So we do this. We do this especially, and let's be explicit, we do this with sex. We assume that because something feels right, we have the right to do it, but we don't have that right. And if we take the pleasure outside of God's timing and limitations, it becomes evil. So, third way we violate this trajectory of love is by slackening the line of hope. And so we can despair, we can give up on ever reaching it, or we can presume, we can say we've already gotten there. So we can get to here and we can say, you know what, I'm already perfect. I don't need to do anymore. I've presumed perfection. Or we can get to here and say, it's really hard, I quit. And that just those are both ways of fundamentally giving up. Okay? In a moment, I'm going to turn us to one of the letters of Screwtape, and we're going to look at letter 18 together, but I want to, you don't have this quote down because I found it after I'd printed the notes, sorry. But this is something Lewis writes in an essay called Essays Presented to Charles Williams, and I'll read it slowly because you're just listening to me. So he writes, "A romantic theologian does not mean one who is romantic about theology, but one who considers the theological implications of those experiences which are called romantic." Okay? Not romantic about theology, but what are the implications theologically about these romantic experiences, whether falling in love or beauty or these other places? "The belief that the most serious and ecstatic experiences, either of human love or of imaginative literature, have such theological implications, and that they can be healthy and fruitful only if the implications are diligently thought out and severely lived, is the root principle of all this work." So romantic theology says that when we have experience of love and when we have an experience of beauty, something good is happening. But we have to think about it rightly for it to be fruitful for our growth. And Lewis, in 1940, this is written in 47, in 1941, he's writing a book about spiritual formation where he's trying to shape our understanding of how love works. So let me just highlight. If you'd like with me, let's look at letter number 18, if you've got your books. I won't give a page number because it won't matter. We've all got different books. By the way, next week, Elliot is going to be here, and I'm hoping he's going to take photos of all the different covers we have because I think it's quite exciting. And so we'll build a little collage of those things and share them. So I'm excited. So I won't read the whole letter, but let's go through this together for a moment. So my dear Wormwood, even under Slubgob, you must have learned at college the routine technique of sexual temptation. And since, for us spirits, the whole subject is one of considerable tedium, though necessary as part of our training, I will pass it over. But on the larger issues involved, I think you have a good deal to learn. Now, pause. First thing first. Screwtape, the demons have no bodies, so they have no sense of physical pleasure. And so Lewis is thinking that if I were a demon thinking about physical pleasure, I have no avenue into this. They seem to enjoy this, but I don't understand why. And so he's never focused really on sexual acts as the problem. He's, how can I manipulate them for maximum spiritual destruction? He's going to manipulate the spirit. Okay. Second paragraph. The enemy's demand on humans takes the form of a dilemma, either complete abstinence or unmitigated monogamy. Ever since our father, Satan's, first great victory, we have rendered the former very difficult to them. It's hard to be chaste. Lewis knows it. Everybody knows it. It's not a secret. It's hard, right? And so, but it's part of our fall. The fall is what makes it hard, okay? The latter, that's monogamy, for the last few centuries, we have been closing up as a way of escape. We have done this through the poets and novelists by persuading the humans that a curious and usually short-lived experience, which they call being in love, is the only respectable ground for marriage, right? If you're not in love, it's not worth it. That marriage can and ought to render this excitement permanent, and that a marriage which does not do so is no longer binding. This idea is our parody of an idea that came from the enemy. God really is calling you through the experience of love. He really is drawing you to something, but the experience is not the main thing. But the parody is, oh, God gives you this experience, you deserve it all the time, right? And now if you're not getting it, it gives you permission to make all sorts of moral choices. You see this subversion and distraction that begins to happen. We're not going to read the whole letter, but a couple more paragraphs. The whole philosophy of hell rests on recognition of the axiom that one thing is not another thing, and especially that one self is not another self. My good is my good, and your good is yours. What one gains, another loses. Even an inanimate object is what it is by excluding all other objects from the space it occupies. If it expands, it does so by thrusting other objects aside or by absorbing them. A self does the same. And he has an idea of how Lewis is floating that idea about how the demons want to absorb rather than to exist exist with others. I want to highlight the whole philosophy of hell is a phrase you'll probably use this later. The one principle of hell is I am my own from George MacDonald. But this in its own kind of coded way, is the philosophy of Nazi Germany. My good is my good. Your good is yours. And we will expand until our good is all. He's subtle commentary on the kind of cultural climate. But coming out of the sense of, you know, hey, I don't belong to another. I don't know. What you want doesn't matter to me. What I want matters to me. Do you see the exact opposite of this journey is saying, I've had this vision, but I'm going to choose what I want for me completely. Nobody else matters. Okay? And so we get a picture of this. Next paragraph. Now, the enemy's philosophy is nothing more nor less than one continued attempt to evade this very obvious truth. He aims at a contradiction. Things are to be many, yet somehow also one. The good of one self is to be the good of another. This impossibility he calls love. And this same monotonous panacea can be detected under all he does and even all he is or claims to be. Thus, he is not content even himself to be a sheer arithmetical unity. He claims to be three as well as one in order that this nonsense about love may be find a foothold in his own nature. At the other end of the scale, he introduces into matter that obscene invention, the organism, in which the parts are perverted from their natural destiny of competition and made to cooperate. You get a picture of the church there, right? If we're an organism, we cooperate. We work together. We're different parts, recognizing our balance and scales. And not all of us has equal strengths. But if we're competing, we can eat the weak, right? Okay, that was. You're supposed to laugh at that. Sorry. Okay. Thank you. Let's see about this for a second. Okay, so I'm about to talk about the Trinity, and I want you to know that every time you draw anything about the Trinity, you are entering into heresy. So, just with that caveat, just be clear about this. So, if God is, we have this tension. We have one God, and we have three persons. All right. And this is our doctrine of the Trinity. It's very important, actually absolutely essential to Christian theology. If God is only one, he's all in all, nothing else, it's always a one-way street. You could receive from him, but you can't get to him because he's too far other. He's too high up. And all your thoughts about him are provisional and faulty, and he's in some fundamental ways unknowable, and really all you can do is obey. That's it. And hard, and in some ways... Islam, which arrives in the 7th century, is a reassertion of the a radical reassertion of the oneness of God, the only oneness of God, against Christian Trinity, right? So if you're ever in the Dome of the Rock in Israel, you'll find the written inscription top of it says, "You shall not say God is three. You shall not say God has a son." Explicit rejection of the Trinity, central to many of the claims of Islam. But Christian theology holds that God is one God in three persons. So we have this business of the Father, and we have the Son, and we have the Holy Spirit. And there's a interesting thing. So one of the things we say is, we use this phrase, we say God is love, right? From John. All monotheist religions agree that God is love, okay? We can also, hold on for a second, bit of a logic puzzle. We also say that God existed before creation. Okay? If God is love, who did he love before creation existed? Like, if love requires an object of love to be love, if love requires something else, how did God fulfill his obligations to be himself before creation existed? Because if God loves creation, then God's love is what we'd say contingent. It depends upon creation for its existence. And that's intolerable because creation doesn't exist on its own. It's a creation of God. And so this goes back to a theologian called Richard of St. Victor. The answer is that if God is to be love and God doesn't depend on anyone else outside of God to fulfill his nature, somehow the nature of love must be expressed within God. And so that necessitates some kind of multiplicity within God. If you didn't follow that, don't worry. I'm not going to quiz you on it later. But what we get is the Father and the Son and the Spirit are living in a relationship of love where the Father loves the Son loves the Spirit loves the Father, and they express God's central nature by means of this eternal relationship. Now, that may sound fuzzy for the moment, but what God has done is, of course, God sends the Son to incarnate in the created world. Okay? He lives, he dies, we'll have it here. We never draw the empty tomb because it's really hard to draw, okay? But here you go. There's an empty tomb, okay? He lives. He's resurrected. And now what happens is that you and me, we hear the news of faith, okay? And we believe in this story, and the Holy Spirit comes and fills us, and this means that we are being inevitably brought into a relationship with the triune God. That's Christian theology. You are going to be brought into a relationship with God, a permanent relationship, by means of the Spirit filling you, making you like Christ, so that you can be sons and daughters of God. You can have life in the Trinity. This is what the apex of Christian theology is. This is where we go. And this is also this vision. Okay? Theology lesson over. There we go. Heresy, just know, okay, I drew pictures. That's not how it works in these things. And now, I just want to highlight one last thing from Screwtape itself, and that's, you haven't read letter 19 for this, but if you go to the first paragraph of letter 19, I have been thinking very hard about the question in your last letter. If, as I have clearly shown, all selves are by their very nature in competition, and therefore the enemy's idea of love is a contradiction in terms, what becomes of my reiterated warning that he really loves the human vermin and really desires their freedom and continued existence? And then hear this, I hope, my dear boy, you have not shown my letters to anyone. He just gave away the big secret. He's saying, this is the main thing. God made you for relationship with himself, and we will do anything we can to subvert that relationship. All right? That's my talk for tonight on these things, and I want us to take five. If you need to use the restroom. Let's come back, and I'll give us instructions on the next part of discussion. Sound good?